Welcome to the afternoon, those of you who maybe just arrived here. Yeah, that's lovely. What it is I've been reflecting on, I've been reflecting on my own Dharma practice in the light of my gender conditioning, and I've been reflecting on yours in the light of yours from afar. But also I have a very dear friend, Jill Mathewson, who's doing a PhD at the moment on women in architecture. And she's in her third year of that research. And we've known each other for over 30 years, I think about 35 years. And we tend to have these long Skype sessions where we're exploring some of this material. And I find a lot of it really relevant to our Dharma practice, actually, you know, because I suppose because we're looking at conditioning in particular in relationship to leadership. Yeah. And alongside that, I have a long-standing fascination with Bhante's exposition of the true individual, you know, and the characteristics of a true individual. And what started to happen is they're starting to move together. But it's not a finished piece. It's more like these are some of my thoughts so far. I've got in the filing cabinet of my mind, I have all these wonderful pithy things taken from all sorts of research that's been done around women in leadership. And I had to spend quite a bit of time deciding which ones not to put in here, you know, because it would be a bit overloaded. So I thank you all for having given me the opportunity just to explore that and to explore it with you and to explore it in conversation. So how I'd like to do it is I'd just like to share my thoughts, then I'd like us to grab a cup of tea and get into really small groups, no more than three, and I have a list of questions under each of the five characteristics of the true individual as put forward by Bhante. And I thought we could discuss those in more detail. Then we could come back together for a bit of a plenary. And then I have an undertaking I seriously want to challenge you to do before you leave this room. Yeah, I'd like us to lay down our banners and say, I will do something as a result of this. So that's what I'd like to encourage you to do at the end. Yeah. So that's kind of the shape of the afternoon. So it began, in a funny kind of way, it began more in terms of Dharma practice, when I had a conversation with Maitreya Raja earlier this year, and he was looking for a Dharmacharini to co-lead the summer open retreat with him. And he has this every year. He needs to find at least one Dharmacharini to co-lead the open summer retreat with him. Anyway, this time he sort of met up with me and we had a coffee, and he said, historically, I have a lot of difficulty in finding a Dharmacharini to do this work with me. But it's really important. He said a lot of really good women come to the open summer retreats. Often it's their first contact with the Dharma, or it's very early on in their contact with the Dharma. They just need to know that, you know, a woman can practice. They need that sort of connection, and that will really help move them on. And he said last year, he asked 9 women, Dharmacharinis, before one said yes. Some years, he's not been able to get a woman at all. So I thought, one of the studies that I've read about is that the way women are asked to do things matters. Yeah? Apparently, if you just ask us straight out, as a generalisation, we will go yes or no, but more tendency to no. If it's explained to us what the value is, we're more likely to say yes. I thought Maitreya Raja's read that study. But actually, in all seriousness, it came out of his genuine concern for women who were coming along to these summer retreats, which he's done for some years. And he was very, very open. He said, I'm willing to do the lion's share of the teaching, if that matters, or to do less or more to suit a Dharmacharini. I'm willing to explore the theme. You know, he was really bending over backwards to make it accessible and, you know, easier to say yes. So, of course, I am responding to that. So I go, as I sometimes do, well, if you can find no one else, Maitreya Raja, I'll do it. And famous last words, really, aren't they? And also I said I'd take it to the private preceptors' kula that I'm part of and just sort of air it there, because I thought, actually, it's important. So what then happened, of course, is other people couldn't do it, other women couldn't do it, and I will honour what, as far as possible, I will honour when I've given my word. And I really would have preferred not to have done it, actually. I thought, I have a really full life. I do have a full life. I actually have very little time to go on retreat for myself, so even less if I go on retreat and, you know, am involved with leading. I've never done an open summer retreat before, and it's been well over a decade since I've been regularly involved with newcomers, and I didn't feel confident. I felt nervous about it. I mainly work with women, you know, who've asked for ordination, or within my mitra study group where there's an ongoing deepening of practice. So for all these reasons, I thought, oh, I don't know that I want to do it. But I had promised, so I said I would do it. And I have to say, I'm very glad I did say I would do it. And I thought it was a really important experience for myself and for, you know, and for the retreatants. I could really, really see the value of these retreats. But whilst I was there, I began to get a lot of positive feedback from both men and women about how lovely it was to see a woman up front teaching. Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then we went into silence, and a young woman came and sort of nabbed me, you know, just, you know, as people do, don't they? Just as you come out, I came out the shrine room, and she said, I just have to say something to you, you know. And I said, oh, okay. And she talked about having come along and been coming to the centre, and she'd been taught by very good Tama teachers. She'd she'd received teaching from Yana Bhatia, Maitreya Bandhu, Maitreya Raja. And she was saying, and I feel very respectful towards those men and their practice. But I began to realise that I wasn't having those kind of experiences with women. And I began to wonder, was it just that I'm being sexist and valuing what men say and not what women say? And she'd got herself into a bit of a muddle about it all. And sort of had ended up blaming herself as though she had some kind of inner sexist thing that was going on. And then she realised when she heard me teaching that it was just the fact that she hadn't been around a woman teacher, and that she did respect women and she did respect women teachers, and it wasn't a gender specific thing, but it was a really important thing for her to see a Dharmacharini in action and to know that she could practice and that there was somewhere to go with her practice. And there was just something about her obvious, uncomplicated sincerity and observations of herself and the situation that really struck me. And I thought, oh, there's something for me to reflect on, to think something for us to reflect on. So I started to wonder, well, where are we? There is no doubt that, you know, there are a lot of Dharmacharinis involved in the wider movement around the LBC, meeting up with people, mitra study groups, leading retreats. It's not that we're not there, it's not that we're not doing things, but what's going on here? So the question was, where are we in terms of our visibility? And are we visible enough to the new women of all ages coming through? That was one of the questions. Are we to them specifically? So I know from my own experience working with I have quite a propensity to self-doubt. So I know from my own experience and from being involved a lot with mentoring others that confidence is an issue for a lot of us. You know, that often will be the thing that we will draw back from doing something because of a perceived lack of confidence. But I suddenly wondered if that was true. I've begun to think, is it actually true? Is it as simple as just a lack of confidence? I'm not sure that it is. Is it actually a lack of confidence, or is it something else? So that sort of was nudging away in my mind. And I wondered how we hold ourselves back, actually. Mm. How we hold ourselves back, if we do. And is there something about how we're organised or how we do things that contributes to holding us back from stepping forward? You know, it's a very strong sort of gender debate, isn't it, really? Is it individual or is it the conditions of the environment? But sort of bigger than all of that for me is whatever the reasons, and there'll be many and varied, Are we individually and collectively stepping up to the challenges of spreading the Dharma? You know, I just feel so deeply that the world so definitely needs the Dharma that, you know, we could all have 1,000 arms and 11 heads and it might not be enough. You know, there's just so much need out there. And just how deeply it is actually needed there, you know. But often it means stepping out into the unknown, isn't it? And I wondered sometimes if a lack of confidence was actually confused with how we relate to being in the unknown. I know they're related, but I think they've got slightly different flavours and maybe different ways of them working with it. So a bit like the question you asked earlier on today, Abhayanandi, mine was, do we know the limits of our comfort zone? I just wondered if we knew where the limits were, do you know? Do we know where the edges are? And do we consider it spiritually important to step over them? You know, I think we can be very aware of the psychological effect of stepping over them or not stepping over them and what we do around those edges, but, you know, do we have a spiritual imperative to? So those are the kind of questions, really. And I knew that somehow our gender conditioning has had an effect, but I wanted to explore what kind of effect did it have and what relevance, if any, does it have to us in the spiritual life? Because we're on a path of growth and development. I don't think we're easily bounded by convention in our order. I think we're working against that. But what effect does it still have? So I'd just like to explore some of the thinking and the research around gender and leadership under these headings of the true individual. But first of all, I just want to say a little bit about gender as I'm going to be using it here, because that term's used in a plethora of ways, and sometimes in the literature it's very interchangeable with sex, which just means your biological sex. Yeah, I'm a woman, you're a man. You're a man, other people are men. Men are men. So we have obvious difference, we have, you know, biological differences, and they're obvious and they're marked, you know, that's quite clear, isn't it? But the meaning of these differences is complex, it's a lot more complex, because they're socially and culturally constructed, yeah? So they become tied up with things to do with behaviours, personality traits, qualities, expectations, attitudes, etc., etc. They get very, very, a lot gets wound around the simple fact that we have a different physical form and we reproduce and give birth. Yeah, a lot gets put onto that. But basically, it's a set of beliefs and identities that support these biological, cultural, and social differences. Yeah. So in a way, we're looking at a very deep level of view, actually. View built around the body, basically. Yeah. And I wanted to know how much these socially and culturally constructed differences actually contribute to psychological and spiritual differences. Yeah. Because I think there's been some quite crude exploration of this within our movement in the past. So it's a socially constructed construct, you know, culturally constructed, but its impact and the way it sort of manifests is to do with its sort of where it's located, so the particularities of a situation. So that for us, what I was interested in is what if any particularities happen with us as Dharmacharinis within the Theravada Buddhist order and community, you know? What does that particular location reinforce or not reinforce about socially and culturally constructs of gender? And of course, it's quite clear that in the world, it's one of the bases of inequality. It's not the only one, but it's one of them. But there's inherent difficulties in looking at gender. I think it's a bit of a minefield, actually. I think there's big traps. So one of the most obvious ones is, if you go there, if I go there, which I'm trying to, one can always be in danger of surrendering to the sort of binary nature of gender assignment to the other. So men are like this, women are like this, we're not what men are, and you just get this polarization. So it sort of fixes something. And I think that's often the one, you know, that's the populist one, I think, you know. So, and there's a difficulty with that, actually, you've just fixed something. To not go there, to say it doesn't matter, it's all individual choice, you know, whilst there's some very positive things about the notion of individual choice, if we don't go there, what we risk doing is sort of making all women the same somehow, which is also not true, and then dismissing gender, but also it's sort of to miss the obvious thing that neutrality is seldom possible, actually. It's very seldom possible that gender is a neutral thing in any situation. Yeah. So I feel a bit like I'm trying to walk the space between going there and not going there somehow, trying to find a way through. So forgive me if I'm a bit crude myself about my thinking, but I just want to share with you some of it. So the idea for me was, well, what kind of useful dialogue can we have about gender? Yeah? What kind of useful dialogue can we have about gender? And what would be a helpful model for looking at this for us as Dharma Trainees? You know, I wanted to put it within the framework of our Dharma practice. So another way that often that gender is looked at is in terms of constraint. Yeah? What these gender constructs constrain in us? What they make it difficult for us to do? You know, the sort of, I'm really reminded of Virginia Woolf. Do you remember when she said for a woman, it was like starting the race at the same point as a man, but she'd already had to run up a hill to get there, you know, when she was talking about equality. Yeah. So, but if you go to constraints only, you get a very deterministic model. Yeah, you get a very deterministic model. If you go to choice only, you get a sort of view, if you like, which is not accurate, it's not realistic, but it erases any structural and cultural restraints that limit choice. Yeah? So everything then becomes down to the individual. So if you're unable to do something, it's an individual fault. It's not to do with the constraints or the structure or the construct of the situation you find yourself in. So I was just thinking, oh, Bhante, help! You know? And then I thought, oh, it's a true individual. That's where we could really place, I think, a valuable discussion. So rather than looking at where we are now, although it's really helpful and I hope we will do that as part of our discussion, but looking at where we are going or who we are becoming. And as Dharma practitioners, we're becoming more and more of a true individual. I mean, that's the qualities of the enlightened mind. The characters of the enlightened mind are really sort of laid out in the true individual. So Bhante is really clear. He says that the biggest problem in human and spiritual terms is the problem of the individual. Yeah. I thought that was really telling. The biggest problem in human and spiritual terms was the problem of the individual. And by that, he did not mean that the individual herself is a problem. Yeah, he was quite clear about that also. He said it was a problem of the survival of the individual, that it's difficult to exist, grow and develop in the West because it's difficult for the individual to exist, grow and develop. And that's because of the power of the group. Yeah? So he was saying the individual needs protection from the group and we need self-reflective consciousness. So I just want to flag that up, that what we're trying to do is we're going against a very strong group grain. And I think that's, I don't know how you experience it, but some of these deeper conditionings, I feel like they're in my cells, you know? They're really in my cells. It's hard to separate them out of view because I'm so identified with them, so merged with them, if you like. So the first characteristic of the true individual is to be aware of being aware, that we are aware of being aware. So this is about having a reflective consciousness as opposed to the simple consciousness that just is aware of things or senses but isn't aware of being aware of them. So we're conscious of being an individual, aware of being separate from the group, and able to act and think differently from the group. Yeah. Able to act and think differently. And where that led me is I just thought, well, are we aware of our own importance as Dharmacharinis? Because I'm increasingly aware of each of our importance in the world as Dharmacharinis. We're really aware. We're practicing the Buddha's Dharma quite explicitly within Tri Ratna Buddhist Order for the well-being of others. It's absolutely explicit, that other regarding altruistic aspect. And we have influence. We have a lot of influence, us Dharmacharinis. We have the possibility of shaping opportunities for others to come into contact with the Dharma, being part of Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma, and making it visible and accessible to people living in a modern world with all its complexities. Yeah? And I think sometimes we don't realise that we're part of shaping how we relate to the world around us and how we step into it, yeah, and what effect we have on it. So we're involved with a lot of critical issues just by virtue of being part of chapters, having friendships with other order members, being Kalyana Mitras to women in the movement, private preceptors, being on centre teams, leading courses, classes, study groups, being part of chapters, being part of retreat teams, festival teams, you know, the representatives that take information from like the chapter conveners onto other bodies. There's a lot that we're involved with and we influence the shape of the future as it's evolving. Yeah. And this will impact on future generations. We're already impacting on the next generations. Yeah. And it's absolutely vital, our engagement is absolutely vital to the spread of the Dharma in the West. Yeah. So I want to rejoice in all of us. I really want to rejoice in what we're doing. And I want to ask you, are you aware of your importance, your worldwide importance, yeah? Your cosmic importance? So the second thing under this heading of awareness is, are we aware of our gender conditioning, where it's helpful and where it isn't, and engaging with that? And that gets a bit more tricky, doesn't it? I find that a bit more tricky, because where my gender conditioning morphs into things that happened to me as a child and my psychological conditioning, that gets really hard sometimes for me to start to peel one away from the other or know which bit to work on or, you know, quite how, what to do about that. So gender is durable. It's maintained through social practice. It's maintained through repetition, basically. It's just thought about over and over again. We act in certain ways over and over again. We think, we feel, we relate to each other over and over again. And therefore we keep constructs, we keep views in place. Yeah. But it also works with other classifications, that other ways that people are classified. So it also sort of interpenetrates ethnicity, age, disability, class, wealth or economics, education, background. So you can see that it can be quite difficult somewhere to unpick some of that. Yeah, because it sort of interpenetrates all those other classifications that also bring with them helpful and not so helpful conditioning, but also have constraints or choices in different degrees involved with them. So it has this generality, gender conditioning, but it is specific to different situations. But it also can become very symbolic of sort of practical and political issues, gender. Yeah. The thing that I think is really important for all of us to bear in mind, it is not immutable, it is subject to change. So we can see it's been subject to change historically, but even more deeply we know that that's what the Dharma is telling us. Everything's subject to change. Yeah? So how this is viewed will also be subject to change. So the question arising out of that for me was, how does gender affect us as engaged practitioners? Yeah? And I found something in a particular study which I would like to try and share with you, which is called The Model of Domesticity. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten. I think it might be Jean Williams, I think might be the name of the person that did this study. So what she did is she looked at the rise of dual income, dual career families. Yeah? And she noticed that most families fall into this category, far more than 50% fall in the category of, you know, if it's a two adult family, two parents, whatever gender, they're most likely to both be involved in a career and earning income. Or you have the single parent family who are trying to be parent and breadwinner. Yeah. So the bulk of our culture doesn't fit into the traditional domestic, traditional family, which is that one person would have the traditional career of an uninterrupted full-time employment until retirement, based on and enabled by someone else supporting that, yeah, the stay-at-home partner. So it's a historic separation there, she's describing, of work life and private life. And the private life has become associated with reproduction and associated with women. Yeah. The work life or the public life has become associated with production and associated with men. So then what happened was there was this emergence in the mid-19th century of the ideal worker being someone who was unencumbered by domestic tasks, supported by someone else doing them, and highly committed to paid work. Yeah. So what you've got there is that this is all facilitated by the traditional model of the traditional family. Yeah, you've got the traditional family model. Whether or not you were brought up in it, this is the tradition. Yeah. And that set certain conventions in place. Yeah. It set a lot of conventions in place about what the public life was like or the work life was like, particularly around issues to do with rationality and emotional control. So how one would be in those environments. Yeah. And women's career paths have never taken this trajectory. They've never taken that. So what Jean Williams found is that this particular division, which is no longer valid in the West, formed complex gender ideology, which she's called domesticity, and it's still the dominant model in people's minds, even though our working and home lives are not like that. And I thought, well, that's really fascinating, isn't it? Something, we're just living in the calm of a Parker of something. It's ceased to be, but we're still participating in this myth. But this myth has huge expectations or huge views about presumptions, expectations about what's natural for men and what's natural for women. Yeah. Yeah. And all of that's assigned on the basis of sex, and it's basically an oppositional, like one party does one thing and the other party does the opposite, and it's hierarchical. They're not given equal value. Yeah. Yeah. So the question then is, so what do we think's natural for women and what do we not think is natural for women? It's just, I think it's quite important to have a little look at that whole area, yeah, not take it for granted, yeah. And how does that affect our engagement with the spiritual life, yeah? I'm going to say a bit, I'm going to revisit this particular model later on because I think it does have an implication for us. So there's another woman called Virginia Vallian, and she's written about four common explanations for gender comparisons. That's right. Sorry, I can't read my own writing. For gender comparisons. So one of them is that the view is that we have different values and experiences than men. Yeah, and that seems quite valid, doesn't it? Bear in mind this model that I've just flagged up, but you know it does seem quite valid. We have different views, we have different experiences, so we want to do things differently. So this view that I've sometimes heard, within our order, within our community, but also in the outside world when I was involved with architecture and education of architects, is that we, as women, prefer smaller groups. We like more intimacy. We like the one-to-one. We're comfortable. We're effective in there. We know we're effective in those kind of environments. So my question is that true? Is that true? Yeah? Is it true that we actually value that? Yeah? Or are we stepping out of our comfort zone if we participate in a larger arena? So, you know, there can be a view that, oh, it's our different views and our different experiences and our different way of doing things, and that's why we do that. And if we accept that, is there in that a way of avoiding that actually if I step outside my comfort zone and do something that is a stretch, I'm going to feel the discomfort of it, you know, if not the difficulty of it, yeah? So there was another study done by two women, and their surnames are Eagley and Carly, and they talk about how agency is assigned to men, so agency, action, which is about assertion and control, and to women is the communal is assigned to women, which encompasses collaboration and compassion. And by this stage of my reading, this was all having that horribly familiar feel, yeah? Now, I value collaboration, I really value collaboration, I really value compassion, but there was something about the assignment of it to our gender, but also to, like, and that's all you would be, you know, that's your realm, if you're like that, that I was beginning to feel a bit uncomfortable about. But then also, I happened to have a conversation with a young Mitra in the sub-35 group, and she told me something, and it kind of blew something open for me. And the question I have to ask you about is, even if this is true that we're better at small groups and one-to-one, and we're better at that kind of intimacy, and we're more effective, do we notice the effect on others, especially other women coming along? So this is the story this young woman told me, very intelligent, articulate young woman. She said, when you first come to any Buddhist centre, yeah, gender's not an issue. You know, her generation don't experience gender as particularly an issue in their personal or work life, and so they don't expect it to be there in the world around them. Yeah. So they come along, and you come to the different, you know, open day, what do you call them, newcomers classes, and you're getting very inspired, and there's very good teachers, so there's no doubt you're getting good teaching, and most of them are men, if not some of them, all of them done by men, and you don't think that's an issue, because you're in your life and you're just soaking up the Dharma, it's the beginning of something. But then there becomes a particular point when you want to go deeper in your Dharma practice, and the men's way of doing it is really clear, yeah? It's really clear because the men who are leading the classes are asking young men to come on teams of retreats with them. They're asking them to come on class teams with them. And they're setting up study groups for them. And you suddenly find yourself, because of your gender, not included in that particular opening. So you know that women are involved. She said, we know women are involved, we know lots of Dharmacharinis are involved, but we don't see them and we don't have a lot of easy, accessible contact with them. We know they lead study, we know they meet up with people one-to-one, but what we don't know is how do we get some of that? How do we get access to it? How do we meet these Dharmacharinis? And she said, it suddenly seems like the women are in groups and the groups are exclusive, and you can't participate in them. And I honestly felt like my heart was weeping. And I just thought that is one of the effects of us doing things the way we enjoy doing them. And it's not to say that it's not a valid way or not an effective way, but there is an effect. And the effect is suddenly women are feeling like, I don't know where I go here. I don't know how to make the next step. And it's not as easily facilitated as it has been with the men. So then that goes back to my question about how much do we default to group unwittingly? You know, the group's a very, very powerful force. Yeah. So there's no doubt that if we're to attract more women to the Dharma, we need to keep growing and developing ourselves. And I have every confidence that we're doing that in our order and community, you know. But we also need to be visible from the beginning for others. Yeah? Yeah. So there's just, I go back to that thing about that, you know, Maitreya Raja had to ask 9 women before one would say yes to co-leading an open summer retreat with him. It was the 9th person, Kusala Sara, who agreed to lead co-lead a Christmas New Year retreat with Manju Siha. He'd also asked 9. And I don't know what it's like at other centres, Shantamati, but here we sometimes have difficulties with finding women who will do big public talks. Yeah. So the question there for me becomes, in what ways does our need for the group help us, and in what way does the need for the group hinder us, yeah, from becoming more of an individual? So the second characteristic of the true individual is to be emotionally positive, full of goodwill towards all living being. And I think that means we need to know about our individual and collective successes, because we've got a lot to be proud of, a lot to be proud of. So Virginia Valian, you know, the woman who spoke about the 4 common explanations for gender disparities, one of them is called the pipeline phenomenon. So it's this thing that we don't have the same opportunities, yeah? And so you sort of get bottlenecks. And I called up Dharma Dinner, you know, one of our wonderful pioneers, and got all sorts of statistical information from her. So this used to be very true. It used to be very true within our community for women. For instance, there was considerably fewer women got ordained than men until T. Ratnaloka came online. And I remember there were huge numbers after that. I was ordained as one of 17, and there were really big ones. And then we got down to slightly smaller, but every year. And that was basically because a bottleneck had been cleared, you know? It wasn't to do with the fact that we were less able to practice the Dharma or less able to be ordained, although that was often said. It was literally a logistical issue. Yeah? It had nothing to do with our practice. Yeah? So if you look under the pipeline, there's sort of 4 ways of looking at it in terms of leadership. So I've just applied them to us because it's just a way of organising my information. So one's entry. So there's more or less the same number of men and women mitras at our centre. I don't know what it's like at other centres. Slightly more women have become mitras this year than men for the first time for a while. Similar numbers are being ordained of men and women. Internationally, it's the same number of years for men and women between asking for ordination and being ordained. 7 years, both genders. So if you hear people talking about it takes women longer, even if they're referring it to in the positive, because we're more thorough, that's one of it, isn't it? We're more thorough. You know, we like to consolidate more. Well, we may be more thorough, we may be consolidating more, but it's taking us no less time than if we do it anyway else. It's important to know it, isn't it? Because I can believe those myths, but actually it's a myth. Yeah. Participation. So that's another way of looking at kind of how gender might be playing out. So in the life of the order and the community, in the life of the LBC, which is my local centre, Dharmacharinis are very active. In fact, I think there's more Dharmacharinis involved in the life of the community than there are Dharmacharis, but the ways we're involved are different. And that goes back to this issue about the groups. So it's apparently easier to get women mitra study leaders, I hear, from Jayaka. You know, we are very good at signing up for mitra study, smaller groups, less on retreats, leading retreats, these bigger talks, those sorts of more, I think, standalone visible things. Yeah. Then there's progression. That's another way. That's another way you measure if there's gender differences or inequalities going on. Well, for us, there's increasingly a 50-50 split in terms of people who take major responsibility in our community and in our order. So there's very similar numbers between for the public preceptors, for instance. Yeah, I think there's maybe one or two more men, that's all. And there's two women in the pipeline, so that's already kind of worked with. For private preceptors, I think there's about 20% more men, but there's also a lot of women in the pipeline, so that feels very, very healthy. And that's just looking at progression in one way. I'm just looking at it at around a certain kind of responsibility. There are lots of other ways. Yeah, lots of other ways. Just thinking about Padmalila and Abhayanandi setting up Lama's pyjamas and just getting off their seats and deciding they were going to do it. And just now we have this very, very successful project for which I'm immensely grateful, because you give so much money to the LBC that I then can spend on Padrasana. So, there's lots of different ways that, responsibility is shown, isn't it? And then, of course, what's done in leadership models in the business world or in the professional world is you measure success. Now, I do not want to get into a discussion about how many men or women are stream entrants. I'll leave that for someone else with a better mind than mine to get themselves around. But I just thought, well, how could we measure it? And I thought we could look at the altruistic activity of our community. And I think it's healthy. I think we have a healthy altruistic momentum within our community. But what's interesting in studies to do with professional success of women in previously male-dominated fields, and this includes very male-dominated fields like engineering, for instance, the common characteristic of women's success is persistence. It's just staying in there and being persistent. And I thought that, for me, is a quality of emotional positivity, is having some stickability. And I feel very grateful to those women who went before me who showed immense stickability, I remember Malika talking to me years ago now about, she was the only Dharmacharini in Glasgow, and one day she was stopped in the street by a male mitra and told the men no longer wanted to meditate with the women, so she couldn't do it. But there were no Dharmacharinis. And, so she was once again having to stand on her own. And I'm grateful for women like Dharma Dinner, just all the pioneering that those before me have done. I do feel like we enter into a field because of their ability to just persist, but also we have the opportunity to stand on their shoulders because they persisted. Yeah. So I'm very, very grateful. So my questions in this section around emotional positivity are we positive about what we do? And why I want to ask you that is typically research shows that women tend to be judged on their accomplishments and men on their potential to do the accomplishment. And that's quite significant, isn't it? So we're judged on how we perform, not on potential. This is in worldly terms, yeah? So I thought, now that for me starts to make sense of one of the things that holds us back, which I think is perfectionism, yeah? Or that feeling that you have to be kind of 120% sure you could do something before you do it. So I've always thought that was a personal failing of mine between dysfunctional conditioning and being a Virgo. I thought I was doomed to be the perfectionist. But it would seem that actually there's a gender construct in there, and how we're viewed. And I've worked, prior to working in the movement, predominantly in areas where there were very few women. Yeah? So it sort of started to make sense that there's something else at play. So for instance, the skills that women bring to modern leadership, which are inclusivity, having good coach or teacher type dynamics with people, collaboration and relationship building, are very valued. They're valued, and research shows that those businesses or professions that employ those models do better. They do better financially, they do better in terms of the well-being of people there than if you use a simply sort of more traditional hierarchical male model. But we end up hitting a double bind here. Yeah. So it goes back to what we think of as natural. So we and others think it's natural for women to be inclusive, collaborative, compassionate, want to form sort of mentoring type relationships with people they're supposedly managing. So we don't value them. Yeah, we don't value them. So apparently research shows that when these qualities are a man accent with these qualities and he's visible, they're highly valued and they result in career advancement. So I think you have a really good example there of, you know, positive influence of women's conditioning and this whole gender construct. It's taken up by men, they run with it and they get the praise for it. Women don't, because it's seen as natural. And I thought, do we do this with each other and ourselves? That's my question, you know? So when you see a Dharma sister who's done something like handled a difficult communication really well, or, you know, facilitated a group really well, do you say to her, well done, or do you think, yeah, of course anyone can do that? Yeah? There's something there, isn't there? So it's just something about do value it. Then another question I had was, are we positive enough to experience aloneness? So my own experience, and I know it's some of yours too, so bad dramatic, these wonderful cups of coffee we manage to squeeze in every now and again when we talk about these things. There's something about taking more responsibility and being up front. You are more alone and the eight worldly winds blow. Oh my God, they blow. They really blow, and sometimes it's not pleasant. But I think it's intrinsic to growing into greater aloneness and standing with aloneness. So I just wanted to share my cutting edge in all of that. So I really like sharing the Dharma. I really like being involved with groups. But my cutting edge is giving Dharma talks to large groups of people who are cold to the Dharma. There's something about it. It makes me incredibly nervous. I know I don't do as well as I normally do, and I know I'm more tense and I'm not at ease. So a while ago, I started saying I would do open day talks, even though I didn't want to do them, because I knew that this was for some reason. I don't even know what gets triggered, because I'm still in this LBC shrine room. I'm still at home. But I knew that this is the thing that I really would rather not do. And honestly, I have fantasies about contracting terminal diseases or being knocked down by a bus beforehand. You know, it's really quite strong that I don't want to do it. Added to which, I then get very thingy about being filmed or recorded and won't allow myself to be filmed or recorded, which is why I'm allowing myself to be recorded and filmed now. Because my friend Jill and I had a conversation 2 weeks ago, and I promised her that I would record every talk I gave from now on. What the risk is in sort of standing up and trying to do your best to share the Dharma, and the risk is that you will change, that the ego will be challenged, and quite deeply challenged, actually. It's a fundamental spiritual risk, and we need to be able to risk it. So I want to ask you, how are we with each other around where we're stepping out? Yeah. So research shows that women's mistakes are more visible than men's. You know, so some of our concerns are really well-founded. Yeah, we're more likely to be publicly criticised. And we're more likely to have it used as a way of confirming a view that women aren't as good as men. So it's more loaded for us. Yeah, it's more loaded. Women in public life are more scrutinised. Yeah, research shows that. And so what, Dharma sisters? So what? Because I think that what we need to do, what I need to do, is develop more positivity to not take those things as personal. Because they are not personal to me. They're a construct. But they become personal because somewhere I've believed it. Yeah? I've believed it. Yeah? And do we do that to ourselves, and do we do it to each other? You know? So what can we sort of helpfully do to support each other sort of peeling away our identity from these views and stepping out. Because we need to step out because the world needs the Dharma. It's as simple as that. Yeah? The third one was being spontaneous and creative. Yeah? Bhante says, in thinking, feeling and acting, not by predetermined, previously existing psychological patterns, her own or the group's. Yeah? So it's almost like being able to act without reference, isn't it? Just spontaneously. So in this category, I just wanted to remind you of some of the pioneering things that have gone on within our community, pioneered by women. This is not an exhaustive list, yeah? But I wanted to remind you of what us and our Dharma sisters have done. So we have Going for Refuge groups. They were started by Jayashree in New Zealand. Yeah. We have women's communities and women's right livelihood businesses. We have retreat centres. We have Taraloka, Tiratnaloka, and until relatively recently we had two Viharas, didn't we? We have centres that have been started by women. I was thinking of Guna City going off with Satchapada to start a centre in the Highlands. And she herself, I remember she went to see Bhante and she wasn't sure if she was like, if she was sort of good enough for it. And he went, a little Dharma goes a long way. Yeah, just a little goes a long way. And they've both proven that very true, haven't they? Karuna Maya and all her wonderful work in India. Karuna Matti and the Green Tara Trust that she set up. Kusla Sara setting up a group for women under the age of 35. There's been publications, hasn't there? There's been Subhadra Matti's book. There's been Malika, you remember, who started Dakini. It was a women's magazine. Went for years and years and years. Yep. Women ordaining other women, Ratnasuri being the first. I kind of think Dharmadina's whole life has been pioneering. I think some of those women from that era, definitely. And I think women like Mudita Shri, coming from a culture that hadn't been so involved with the Dharma at the time she came along, also just shows pioneering spirit. So I think we stand on the shoulders of many courageous, committed and sincere practitioners of the Dharma. And, you know, all power to them, but also somehow know that it's not by accident, and it wasn't that it was always here. Yeah. So then the question is, you'd think, given all this wonderful creativity, all this pioneering, that our experience would stand out. Yeah. Our creativity, our spontaneity would be evident. But is it? Yeah. So for the Dharma to be known, we have to step up. Yeah. I remember years ago now, or maybe it might even be as much as 12 or 15 years ago, we had an order weekend. I can't remember the theme of it or anything, but the outcome was a whole bunch of us sat in a circle and we each said one thing that we would go away and do. Yeah. And Srivati said, I will write a play about the life of the Buddha, get together a troop of people to put it on, and put it on for Wesak. And she had done it within a year, you know, just because she sat there and promised to do it, you know. I think it's good, isn't it? We need some of that. So my questions, I've got a few here, and this is what I would like you to go away from this weekend, having told each other what you will do. What's the next step for you in sharing, teaching, or giving the Dharma? What's the next step? Yeah? Identify it, and identify any help you might need to be able to do it. Because sometimes that's the issue, actually. It's getting the right training, or the right support, or the right help, or the right opportunity. It's not the thing itself, often. Undertake to do it, and make yourself accountable to others for the doing of it. So who are you going to make yourselves accountable to? And who are you going to ask for feedback? So that's under creativity. So the second to last one is being responsible. The true individual is responsible, aware of her own needs and the needs of others. And I would like to add, and aware of the need of the world for us as Dharma practitioners. I think it's completely implicit in everything. Bhante would just take that for granted, but he didn't actually write those words, so... I think there's three levels of need. Needs of ourselves, needs of others, and the need of the world for the Dharma. So if we go back to this study by Virginia Vallian again about the four common explanations for gender disparities, another gender disparity is that women are not socialised to play by men's rules which govern the workplace. Yeah? So we just don't know what the rules are, so we don't know how to play the game, basically. And this one's been very interesting because I also have a recent example of this. So one of the things that we do as women, which I know personally and I know from reading this research, is we wait to be given responsibility by someone else, normally a man. We wait for that. The woman who was head of, she's a CEO at Facebook, and she wrote that book, Lean In. And she said, it's waiting to be asked to sit at the table. Yeah, waiting to be asked to sit at the table. So the Vajrasana project for me became a really big area where that became obvious. So there were four men on that subcommittee and myself, but I'm the only architect. I have the most experience with building, and I know about design processes. Yeah? But I wasn't the, what do you call it? I wasn't chairing that committee. Yeah. So for about a year and a half, my experience was I led from the back seat. Yeah? So I was terribly concerned about not taking over in a meeting, or because, you know, I can get a bit enthusiastic anyway. And, you know, not trying to make people feel uncomfortable and trying to sort of serve the greater good. And I was always sort of, you know, I'd be emailing Paramabandhu, who was the chair, saying, I think the next step would be to do this, this and this, and it would be really good if we researched this. And, you know, so I was always sort of, I mean, I had an influence and an effect, but I felt like I was sort of doing it a bit from the back seat. And, you know, and I was a bit insecure. I was insecure. There were times when I felt quite excluded from certain decision-making processes, for instance, because they happened to happen informally around where they lived, and I'd have to remind them that I didn't have breakfast with them that morning. And, you know, there were some sort of things that also fed into a samskara I have, a feeling easily on the outside, you know, so it's my sore spot, really. And I think I was skillful, but I also was somewhere I felt like I was in the background. Now, whether they experienced me as being in the background is a completely different matter. I don't know that they did, actually, but I felt like I was. And then there was a point where we were about to go into the, you know, being more with the architects and all of that, and I realised that somehow I was waiting, particularly for Yanav Archer as chair, to tell me that that was going to be my job, to be someone to head all of that up. But the thing was, I was already doing all of that, and I thought, oh, a man would just do it because they would just expect that they were the best person for the job, so they would just do it. So I did this out for me, this outrageous thing. I thought, I'm just going to do it until I get told that it's not my place to. And no one's told me yet that it's not my place to. Yeah, because it was implicit in the group that everybody knew I would do that. You know, it wasn't anything to do with what the men were doing at that point. It was me waiting. I was waiting for Yanav Archer to say, this is your job, you know? But it had evolved into my job, you know? Just by the fact of my skills and experiences, that was obvious. And all of those people want what's best, you know? So I just thought, yeah, I suppose my question there is, you know, is there a table that you're waiting to be asked to sit at? Mm. Yeah, that's maybe the question there. And I thought, well, one of the important things around that, you know, you want to sit at a table, you know, so to speak, I love that language, is training, actually. That's what we often need. We just need training. So I remember years and years ago, well before my involvement, Malika led small groups of women in these little workshops around confidence and public speaking and things that would help women, you know, be more upfront. Pardon me, one of the things I really valued about the Thursday night women's class was that was an arena for women to get used to giving talks, for instance, so it was a training ground, you know. But what Maitreya Raja noticed when we were talking about the issue with men and women's involvement and running things and being up front, he's noticed that if when you're ordained, You do start to do things fairly soon after being ordained. You are much more likely to continue to do so and just increase in confidence. It's when you don't for a long period of time, it gets harder to get in. Yeah? So I thought that was interesting in and of itself. It's more difficult to come into after a time. And I found that when for periods I've had to have a time out for a while, mainly due to busyness, and then I go back into teaching, I always feel like I'm less confident or comfortable than I was a few years ago when I was doing loads of it, you know? You just got to get over that hump, don't you, really? But there's so many small next steps we could do. So, like, a really good one for training and teaching is to lead a lunchtime meditation class. And at the moment, there's only 2 women who do lunchtime meditation classes, and there are 12 people involved in that. Yeah? But that's a really manageable one. Your mentor can come and be in the room with you, give you feedback. You know, I know Vidyadhaka and Maitreya Raja are giving people feedback. Shraddhasara's found that a very, very valuable next step. You know, you could just ask if you can go on a team of a course with someone that you respect their teaching of, and just could you do like a small bit? You know, so I know Sri Vatti with Bodhi Tree has Chrissy, who's a mitra, working with her, and she's given her small bits to do, you know, so that she's just getting trained up as it's appropriate for her level of Dharma knowledge and her involvement with large groups of kids. And the other thing there is, don't think of it as only being of benefit to yourself, because I think we get so self-conscious, and given this research about how more scrutinised we are, that's not surprising, but we're not just doing it for ourselves, we're doing it for the benefit of all. And I think that perspective really helps. I think there are things in my life I'm willing to do for the benefit of others. I wouldn't be so willing to do it just if it was just about me. You know, I'd rather watch the telly a lot of the time, as those of you who know me know. And then the fifth and last sort of characteristic of a true individual is dissatisfaction or frustration. Isn't that lovely? Really lovely. And I think it's something to do with a group member, Bhante says, is not necessarily frustrated because they're with the group, you know, and everything's swimming and they're just, they emerged with the group. So it actually points to a greater individuation. And it points to the need for the value of the individual, particularly in Dharma practice. Yeah. So he says, Buddhism places the individual at the forefront of its teachings, shows the individual how to grow, how to develop awareness, emotional positivity, how to become more creative and spontaneous, and how to take responsibility for self and others, having enlightenment as the goal. Yeah. So my question here is, like, let's cherish our frustration. You know, Bhante said that once, didn't he? Cherish our dukkha. Let's pay attention to it. Let's value it. Where do you experience frustration? And if you withdraw blame from that, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? So those are the 5 characteristics I think have got some implications for us as women. But I just wanted to flag up one last piece of research that's been done by 2 women in the States. And they had a breakthrough in their own personal development when they started to relate to each other, not just supporting each other and sort of, you know, well done and good luck with the new book and all of that. What they did was they shared with each other what their core trip-ups were, you know, what the core samskara was. And then they promised each other that they would only relate to each other as a woman who was free of them. Yeah? So they related to each other as the women they were becoming, not who they were and not who they'd been. And she said the breakthroughs they had were really, really radical. And they now run this empowerment program for women worldwide, which is how I found out about their work. And I just thought, can we and do we talk to others, talk to our sisters in the Dharma about who we are becoming? Yeah. Basically, are we talking to each other about freedom, real freedom, about what holds us back, and then start to really relate to ourselves and each other as someone who's already free of it? Yeah. So what they did was they related to each other in that way, and they held each other accountable for behaving in that way, for persisting in that way, and for showing up, is how they put it, showing up in that way. Yeah? Because isn't that what we're all trying to do? It just seemed to me that's exactly what we do. And sometimes I think as women, I don't know if I think this or I wonder this, our sympathy and our understanding lead us not to relate to each other in terms of who we become. Yeah, because we identify with the difficulty. Now, I'm not talking about being harsh or not acknowledging the difficulty or what we each work with, because it's huge sometimes. But there's got to be an and. And this is who you're becoming. You know? And I know for me, I really value my friendship with Pranya Devi in that way. You know, I will do things and Pranya Devi will come to dinner and go, you know, I think the next step for you is it's around my teaching. You need to do this. You need to get out there more. She has more confidence in my ability to teach and share the Dharma than I do. But she relates to me in such a way that by the end of the evening, it's probably Badramati does that too, I'm going, oh yeah, I could do that. You know, with no way at the beginning I would have thought I could have. So there's something very valuable about having a straightforward for each other, isn't there? Yes, in aligned with the values that we hold most dear. So there's a bit of meander through Maitri Vajri's thinking over the last couple of years and cups of coffee with Subhadramati. What I'd like to suggest now is we get a cup of tea, we break into groups of three. I've got, Subhadramati did it for me, some photocopies of those questions, and we could just maybe talk about that for a good half an hour or so. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.